Hey, it's Tobias here. If you want to learn a little bit about my firm or see my portfolio, head on over to acquirersfunds.com. This week's Acquirers podcast is brought to you by my good friends at Validia. Validia runs quantitative stock selection models using factor-based strategies from 22 published books and academic research papers with long-term track records of success. Validia has combed through books about historically successful investors such as Warren Buffett, Ben Graham, and Peter Lynch, and academic research papers that contain unique investment strategies and uses them to run model portfolios it has tracked since 2003. You may recognize Validia since two of its founders, Jack Forehand and Justin Carboneau, both good friends of mine, have appeared as guests on the podcast. Through the end of February, Validia is offering 33% off an annual subscription to both its standard and professional product to listeners of the Acquirers podcast. To find out more about Validia or to take a free trial, you can go to validia.com/Toby. Again, that's validia.com/Toby. And we're live. It's 10:30 on the West Coast, 1:30 on the East Coast. It's 6:30 UTC. I did see the tweets. Thanks for the heads up. I think it's 6:30 AM Australian Eastern Standard Time. It's the Acquirers podcast. What's up, fellas? No, it's value after hours. I forgot where I am.
It's whatever it is. It's on the Acquirers network, right?
That's it.
Everybody, people have a network now.
Omnichannel.
Yeah. Not much. How's everybody doing?
There's some wild speculation in this market. Wow.
Nah, I don't see it anywhere.
Yeah, everyone looks pretty buttoned up.
Getting text messages from everybody. Everybody's punting AMC and GME.
Well, I mean, they were gambling anyway, right? So, oh, punting, that's right. Yeah, that's gambling.
Same thing, yeah.
That's right, yeah. I use English here.
That is, yeah. That's English. That's old country English.
No, sir. In America, we say that everything that we say is correct, and proper English is not English. Sorry.
You think that punting's standing up in a boat and pushing along with a stick?
That's right, no, yes.
It's like drop kicking. That's the...
The drop kick.
That's our punting.
Doing all that with a Bud Light in your hand. That's America. Anyway, what are the topics for today, gents?
I think everybody wants to know what inning we're in, Bill.
Oh, come on, man. We're the GameStop's down 50%, so we're going back
to one.
Game. We're back to inning two.
Oh, gosh.
Meme stocks, bro. Diamond hands.
Yeah, crazy.
Those are not second inning terms.
Diamond hands?
Yeah.
You just don't have enough galaxy brain in you.
I feel like we've had a few speculative kind of manias in this long bull market, and I don't think that it's ever kind of... You would think that it's kind of ticked the top. Like Bitcoin 2017 going bananas. I mean, Tesla last year.
Yeah. All I don't know.
Tech stocks. It's kind of all Tesla's- meaningless, right?
Tesla's the only one that's like really got a lot of market cap to it. And then I guess the SaaS stocks in aggregate. But I don't, those might not be manias, man. They may be justified. I don't need to understand it. Just telling you.
What topics are we talking about today?
Oh, I'm a rant a little bit. So
yes.
Bill's rant.
Yeah.
This is my favorite segment.
What do you got, JT?
I'm going to start abdicating my time to Bill for ranting. Now I've got, I prepared a little piece that's called Sperm Whale Stoicism.
I like it.
So we'll see how that goes.
I don't know how you
went to the zoo last
physics.
Week. I went to the zoo last week and I have a video of a zebra humping another one. It was hilarious. I had to take a, they let this male zebra in and it just got rowdy in there. The female did not like it, but. Anyway, sperm whale reminded me. You're welcome, folks.
Family podcast.
Yeah,
it's family.
How about
stuff.
You, TC? What do you got?
I'm gonna be a downer again. I just think this. Bill and I can have an argument about it in a little bit, but I think we're bottom of the ninth. How many innings are there in baseball?
Dude, come on.
Fourth inning.
Come
late
on
the fifth day in a cricket sense. Very dark shadows across the pitch. You guys love that. You can translate that for the baseball aficionados.
But I think you're saying the game's almost over.
I think there's a lot of speculation, there's a lot of overvaluation, and there's a lot of margin debt packed in there. And I think that SPACs, and I think it's almost time to ring the bell.
Yeah, I mean, that's a cute thing to say. Let's talk about why.
Yeah, Do you want to do it?
Let's you start off. Come on, let's roll.
Ding, 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 ding.
So, nobody cares about valuation metrics anymore, but valuation metrics are all stretched.
Diamond hands.
Cyclical PE 35, exceeded now only by 2000 peak. Buffett measure market cap to GNP, same thing. Now exceeds the market peak. If you just break all of the by decile, Hussman had this great chart yesterday. Basically, every decile is now more expensive than it was in 2000, which is a little bit concerning. And then on the speculative front, margin debt to GDP, all-time highs. People are speculating wildly in call options and things like that. I just think there's a collection of stuff that we're speculating on margin at very stretched valuations, and that's tail end bull market behavior. The prosecution rests.
Yeah, Bill, counterpoint.
It's hard to argue these stats that you use. I guess that when you see the margin debt stuff, do you guys know, are they talking about like Melvin Capital, right? How the amount of leverage that they're using, is that considered part of the margin debt calculations? Because generally what I think my overall answer to this is, yeah, I think forward returns are quite a bit lower than they have been. And I suspect that people are trying to goose those returns with leverage is sort of like what I think is most likely going on. And, you know, I guess I generally think that I just think forward returns are going to suck. And I think that the amount of leverage increases some of like the probability of tail risk for like sell-offs and whatnot. But I don't know. I still think, I mean, like, look at Berkshire, look at Comcast. Like, these things are not like glaringly, obviously overvalued to me. So I just think, I agree with you that there are pockets. I'm just not sure that I think that like we're going back to some other valuation regime, but for rates. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's the other way around. I think it's very broad-based overvaluation with some specific pockets of undervaluation. I honestly don't understand what drives the undervaluation in some of these stocks, because I've tried to create portfolios that are pretty high quality, and I don't have any trouble creating a portfolio that's, you know, better return on equity than the market, faster growth than the market, and all at lower multiples in the market, better free cash flow conversion from EBITDA, like all of these things. I find that all, there are quite a few companies out there, I think, that are reasonably valued, that are undervalued, that are good quality companies. So it's difficult to hold the two concepts in your mind at the same time. But when I look at the, you know, Hussman or Jesse Feller or any of the GDP metrics or any of that stuff, I know that those guys are going to be criticized because they've been bearish for a long time. But I look at the data, and the data is like, I don't care how they interpret it. I look at the charts. I color in the charts. They look pretty stretched to me.
Rear window, front window, buddy. Like, you're just looking out the rear view, and everybody else is looking at the windshield. And, you know?
Well, what are they looking at? That's the answer. Tell me what everybody's looking at.
Well, dude, in 15 years from now, you have no idea how big these companies are going to be, and you just can't get your head around it. So you're going to miss the next great wealth generator.
When I look at
diamond hands,
when I look at back, so the two things, one of them is Ford returns here. Ford returns are, I think Ford returns are about 9%, including 1.5% of dividends. So that means that's a negative 0.6%.
No,
0.9%.
0.9%.
Ford returns are 0.9%. Assuming mean reversion over a decade. Back to normalized ratios, which might be that may not be a reasonable assumption, but that's the assumption.
I don't know if you're going to get it. I mean, I do think there's something to be said for, in the past, a lot of the companies, like, you could build a replacement to the company that you're sort of, you know, if you're like a metal bender or whatever, somebody else can just put up another one if they're willing to have the capital. There are a lot of businesses now that are like truly moat-y that are protected by IP. So they do. I don't know that like margin reversion is an argument I buy. Just saying.
The other thing is that when I look at the big returners, like the gigantic winners over the last decade have been things that started at undervaluation. Microsoft, yeah, undervalued. You know, Sherwin-Williams Paint Company undervalued. Ross Stores undervalued. Retailer. You know, they're all the way that you get the really big returns is you're not trying to pick the business quality alone. You're trying to pick undervalued business quality. And that's how you get the monster returns over kind of a decade.
Yeah, Apple too. Look at David Gardner, though. He's the counterexample that I always use. But I do.
That's
like,
a micro cap universe, though. Small and micro.
No, David, he does mid cap and stuff. He recommends stuff that's big.
All right.
It's just a different way. I mean, I'm not, you know, look, my bias tends to agree with you. I'm half the time that I say that we're in inning three, I'm joking. But I also do think that there's like a lot of reasonable stuff out there right now. I just don't,
so do I.
You know. Yeah. So I guess part of my hesitancy to be like, yeah, this is super late is I think it does sort of turn my brain off from looking for stuff like that. Cause like it makes me almost think about making a market call. And I don't think that that's a very healthy habit for myself.
Well, I don't need to do that because I'm long short, but I can fill up a short book as easily as I can fill up a long book. And I can, you know, the shorts at the moment, to be fair, the shorts have gone against me. So I'm, you know, but I have thought it each time that I've formed them. Gee, these are junky companies for gigantic market capitalizations. Like at some stage, doesn't the quality of the business have to show up in the financial statements, or is that just we're not doing that anymore?
I don't think you need. Well, yeah, I agree, actually, right? It is a supply and demand of shares, and when you are pitching an idea that's 10 years away, who the fuck is to say that your idea is wrong? Like, this is all just pixie dust anyway on a lot of this stuff.
But I don't have to pay up for it.
No, of course you don't. Well, that's the bet that people that sort of have a value bent or whatever are going to be making over the next 5 to 10 years, right? Is like, we're going to be saying, all right, well, this next 5 to 10 years is our years, you know, right? So we'll see.
Well, look, as a microcosm of what's happened, let's look at, you know, your QRTEA, Curate versus Zoom.
Yeah, buddy. Let's talk about it. Let's just wax poetic.
It's going to be the undervalued. Like, Zoom was super, super hot over the last 12 months, particularly like 4 quarters ago, right? Just when we all locked down, everybody was using Zoom. It's still growing very fast, still a great business. It's just that it just stalls out. And Curate, you know, who would touch that with a 10-foot pole? And then
idiots.
Here it is.
Especially in size. That, you know, I love when people come at me and they're like, do you think it'll be a bigger business? No, I don't know. That's not even the question you need to be asking at the valuation that I pitched at, dumbass.
Yeah, it's a capital structure. It's a capital structure more than it's anything else.
Yeah, not everything needs to be how big can this business be in the future. Some things in life are how much cash am I getting back and can I actually handicap what I need to believe in the, you know, going forward. I do, that does trigger me a bit, those conversations, because it's like, you know, some people
like,
that...
That's every single one of these conversations, though, is like it's some cash far out in the future that may or may not show up, right? Relative to cash today, cash in the pockets in the next year or two, because you feel like you have some sense of what the business is going to do. You don't have to have such Herculean insights into what the world looks like 10 years from now.
Yeah. I guess that the only thing that I think that I wish that I had understood earlier is that the math of the right tail and how, you know, if you make a portfolio of bets that you do think will be much bigger in the future, like Ron Barron is a pretty good example. I have been hesitant to like look into his stuff because he benefited from Tesla and I find that offensive, but like his career is pretty freaking impressive. And, you know, his podcast on Masters in Business is worth listening to. He's had a lot of really big wins. So that method of thinking matters. I've just always been so into like, oh, well, how do you know? Cost me a lot of money.
Do you guys have any thoughts on GameStop? Is that sort of...
Yeah, I do. Allow me
is
to
that
rant
your, Is
for
that
a
your
second.
Rent?
Yes. First of all, who the fuck do some of these people think they are pouring fuel on the fire, right? And like fueling this populist narrative that it's the little guy versus the big guy. Chamath, or whatever the fuck his name is, I don't care if I just said it wrong, should have shut his mouth and not announced that he bought those calls. And then he acts like he's donating it to charity out of the goodness of his heart. No, the reason is compliance called him and said, you better figure out a way to weasel out of this thing because you got a ton of followers and you're running people straight to the fire and you're cheering them on Twitter and you're pontificating about a bunch of shit you don't know anything about. That guy needs to treat the responsibility that he has much more, like, with a lot more respect than jumping up on some Wall Street Bets BS saying, I'm going YOLO on some calls. Not to mention, the people that he's leading to the fire could actually be hurt, where he could lose all that money, and it doesn't matter because he's going to get it all in SPAC fees because these lemmings are going to give it to him. That guy has not bothered me until pretty recently, and he's like... I find him very offensive right now. Very offensive.
There are a few guys jumping on that bandwagon, right? Davey Day Trader did that as well. And then
but he's like
Mark
whatever.
Cuban.
I think introducing populism and populist narratives into the market is extremely dangerous. And I think that when you have 100,000 or 200,000 or however many freaking followers that guy has.
Chamath's like 1.2 million.
Yeah, so whatever he has, like, I don't care. I did look at some of his replies. He buys a lot of bots. But anyway, the idea that, like, he is rooting on the small guy, bitching about payment for order flow when SoFi does the exact same thing. Like, how about you actually know your portfolio company? Like, I mean, slow your roll, man. You don't need to have an opinion on everything.
How does Robinhood work? Is it so they don't charge you a fee for what they do, and so rather than front running you, and so this is another way they could be doing it, right? They just make a wide bid ask spread every time you want to trade. They're just in between, but they don't do that either. What they do is that they sell that front running to Citadel, and they get a fee for giving them that data. Is that correct? Is that how it works?
Yeah, I think how it is they route it and Citadel gets the first look and Citadel knows if they can sort of like skim something and then they send it back a little check. I do think that they have to give best order like execution though. I'm not 100% sure how all that works, the internals. But like at the end of the day, the guy that was always going to be hurt here was the small guy at the end of it, right? And I don't buy... I wanted to buy like this, oh, let's all jump on Robinhood thing, right? I got like motivated reasons to believe that. But like, I'm happy that I talked to some smarter people than me and they sort of said like, there's no way, there's way too much volume. It's got to be the big guys. And I just think that like jumping on this bandwagon, you know, we'll see how it all gets totaled out. But I really fundamentally think that what some big names did in this whole story is like really irresponsible. And I know that I sound like an old man, but I really feel like people don't treat the responsibility that they ask society to give them with enough respect. And I think that this was a really good example of that in a couple instances. And it upsets me greatly.
Yeah, I agree. Pretty gross behavior on a lot of fronts. I mean... I was surprised at how quickly it kind of unraveled. Like usually it seems like it would take at least a couple weeks or something, right? But this was like started and ended within before our last podcast.
It did. Right?
Like, it's internet time, I guess. I mean, we knew it was going. We knew it was going on. Jimmy was sort of.
Yeah.
I had Mike Burry as the GIF for the Twitter promo last week.
That's true. All right, so we got 2 weeks worth of fun in it, but
I think it's been going on for a little while. I think that retail really piled in between the podcast and now. and then it broke down. Like, it was already, it was right at the end of that parabola, of whatever that, you know, whatever that shape is. What do you call a broken parabola?
Yeah, I don't know.
The South Sea bubble formation, when it sort of gets to that, when the big move, the last stick is all the way up and then it turns around. Yeah, that did seem to happen very quickly.
The highest point's the apogee, that I know.
The apogee, there you go. The apex, the pinnacle.
Yeah.
What I just, do you guys have any thoughts on the shutdown of trading and like stopping order flow?
Oh yeah, that I did. That I kind of am sympathetic. So this is where I'm sympathetic to the degenerate gamblers. My buddy bought into BlackBerry. I told him not to do it, but he was like, I'm doing it. And then like when they stopped him, right, like they did change the rules on him. And he's like, dude, what the heck? Like it can't go up because people can't buy enough of it. And all of a sudden, like you have like put circuit breakers into the potential of the gambling, which part of me gets upset that there's gambling in the markets. But the other part's like, well, it was going on anyway. So once the dance is going, cutting the music doesn't seem very sportsmanlike.
It was a it was a solvency liquidity issue for Robin Hood, wasn't it? I mean, that's the thing that I find most amazing. Like, that's the most frightening part. That's the scariest thing you can possibly hear, that a broker right at the very peak of, like, we're basically at all-time highs and there's a broker having trouble. What?
Yeah. It's almost like they don't plan for tail risk in certain instances.
Are they planning on them? What happens if the market goes down a bit?
Yeah. It's almost like they don't pay attention to KYC at all.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I mean, I think that, you know, the other thing that really upsets me is like these people that are saying like, oh, it's for the common man or some nonsense about democratizing investing. You're not democratizing investing, yeah, giving people options. Get out of here. And then like these VCs saying like, oh, you know, it's not our fault or whatever. SoFi is just as bad. Like, you guys are all make me sick.
Yeah. I mean, pimping your customers to Citadel and then pretending like you're democratizing trading. That's a little offensive.
Yeah.
It's kind
of like, if I get closed out any of your funds, good. I didn't want them anyway for my rant.
Yeah. Send all the hate mail to Bill.
Man, I'm happy to have the conversation with some of these guys. I think it's nonsense. And I think these guys that sit behind this "we're democratizing investment" thing, like, you know, it'd be one thing if they weren't in finance and they like just didn't know better. But the fact that they know better and they still make, like, how freaking greedy are you? Like, that's, you really got to sell that? Like, you don't have a soul.
But how are they getting paid otherwise? How are they getting paid otherwise?
I don't know. I mean, some of these guys, I mean, look at the VC backers in Robinhood. You can't pass one deal up, like not one.
What if
it works? You got to go out and you got to be loud about how you think you're democratizing investing.
But that's the game, right?
Shut up.
They're all the rebels before, you know, the
empire.
The empire. Yeah, that's like the oldest marketing trick in the book.
There's a difference between quietly backing something and then going out and giving, you know, Wall Street Journal interviews, obviously pumping a false narrative. So that's fine. I'm a no one. I don't respect them. They don't need to care that I don't respect them. Next. Our lives will both be fine, never crossing paths.
Yeah, I never thought for one second
that
they believe what they were saying. I guess that's...
Yeah.
It is pretty creepy selling the order flight, pretending that you're Robin Hood on one hand and then selling the order flight to the Sheriff of Nottingham on the other, or some bandit in the forest, not even the Sheriff of Nottingham.
Well, and this notion of like a lot of our customers are buy and hold, okay. Like just look at the options flow through each platform. It's pretty obvious what's going on here.
You're not buy and hold in options.
I know. Well, that's my point, right? It's not like they're empowering any individuals for real. They're turning people into degenerates or facilitating the process. I won't assign the blame. I will say they are nudging people to the wrong place.
Yeah. Just a lot of gross things happening.
You know, it's just like, how much greed is enough greed? Like, when is enough? And then for some of these guys to, like, I don't know, to just push this populist stuff, man, it's just like, what are you doing? And do you realize the fire that you're playing with? And what scares me even more is that they might realize the fire that they're playing with, and they may like it.
What do you think happens? So what are you worried about?
I mean, you've already got people in the country that don't have faith in the election system. So now you want to have no faith in the financial markets? Like, what is America's competitive advantage if it's not rule of law and financial markets?
I mean,
we're gonna mess around and play with that?
Should you have faith in the financial markets? Should you have faith in the financial markets?
I think yes. I think that on average, America's capital markets are something that people should be proud of as Americans. I think that there are bad things that happen in it? Yeah, I do.
We've had lots of trading before. We've had booms and busts before. This is nothing new. What's new? It's different.
I'm not saying that there's a boom and a bust. What I'm saying is, if you have plenty of money and you attach yourself to it and you front run it for your own attention, I think you're a sick human. That's what I think. I don't care about a short squeeze. I care about influence, people of influence running sheep to the slaughter. That's what I care about. I don't care about a short squeeze on a company that is meaningless in the grand scheme of things.
You know, the other thing that concerns me is that, you know, there's already a fair amount of populists, you know, just a lot of people felt like they have been left behind in the last 20, 30 years. And if you gave them that little bit of hope, like, oh, maybe I can get rich this way, like all these other people have, and then you take it away even if it was like for true liquidity reasons that they actually had to stop taking orders, that's too nuanced for them to care. It feels like you stopped the clock in the third quarter when I was winning, and now you change the scoreboard and I'm losing.
Yeah.
And I mean that, you know, to use kind of Chris Cole's ideas about like risk doesn't get destroyed, but it can be transmuted. And I mean, I think you're turning what was trying to squash financial risk of over speculation and turning it maybe into, you know, pitchfork risk. And I mean, it's just one more thing for people to be upset about and feel like the game is rigged.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you bear any responsibility as an individual investor piling into something like that though? Like you can't be that stupid that you think this is just free upside.
No, but dude, that's what I'm saying, why I have some sympathy with the gamblers, because my buddy that bought BlackBerry he knew exactly that he was gambling. But he was like, now, right, it was already going on. And then once you restrict my ability to buy or other people's ability to buy, well, now you sort of like screwed me in my gamble. So you've sort of like changed the dynamics. And, you know, like, I mean, the problem is you're not playing a game with the same power that everybody else is. And, you know, I think people learned real quick. Maybe their assumptions weren't.
What's the reason Robinhood had to shut it down? Why are they taking any risk there at all? Why aren't they just facilitating the transaction?
So I don't know the answer. Jake, do you know?
I probably don't know enough to say like for sure, but it sounds like it's they can't, like, they have to have certain collateral requirements.
Yeah, that's
with
my
their
understanding.
Broker,
but why would they
with the
with the clearinghouse, right? And they have to like post collateral, right? And
it's moving.
What was going on, they needed to raise capital to stay within the regulators' requirements, is my understanding.
I mean, it's
limited.
It happens all the time that the collateral requirements in your account move up and down. You get a notice, you know, regularly that you need to put more collateral up for something that you're in the PA.
Hopefully not too regularly.
Well,
yeah.
They just change the rules. They just change the rules halfway through. That happens all the time. That's not uncommon.
Yeah. I don't know, man. It's people's reaction. It's not what, like, I mean, you know, and I even tweeted, like, I thought it was kind of humorous that Robinhood halted trading, you know, because the little guy on the little guy when they're, you know, I've always known they're not there for them. But I just, I don't know, the way certain people behave, the way that Elon Musk, like, turned it into about short sellers, like, dude, go fuck yourself. Like, that you haven't won yet. Yeah, people were short your company. Guess what? They got their faces ripped off. Okay, short sellers are good for the market. You may not like them. I don't like these hit jobs on stocks. I don't like pump and dump guys. I don't like frauds. I don't like any of it. The fact of the matter is, short selling to me is as important as free speech. Like, don't turn this into shorts are evil. Chamath calling it un-American. I find your SPAC shit offensive. So, you know, I mean, I just, the whole discussion I thought was sick.
We need a CNBC Buffett. He needs to come out and give us some.
He's in his 90s.
He's been quiet.
He's in his 90s. He's running a very big
Munger
company.
Coming up in our Munger's coming up for Daily Journal here next in this month, another couple weeks. So,
dude, I wish I could ask Munger, when's the last time you set up IPO A B C D E F G H I J K L M N O P? And see what he says about that.
Wasn't it Munger who said, get that money, bro? Or was that
I think it was, yeah. Get the money, then change the world. I understand why people like him. I'm just saying, I think he's towing a very dangerous line. I even liked him on the Ted Seides interview, to be fair. But I don't like what I see right now.
JT, you want to do your market philosophy, life philosophy.
Yeah.
Palate cleanser.
This is a tough act to follow there.
Sorbet.
All right. So this this little segment is called Sperm Whale Stoicism. And it's, I don't know if you guys know a whole lot about sperm whales, but they're pretty incredible creatures. So, you know, they breathe oxygen just like we do, but they're able to hold their breath for up to 120 minutes. And, you know, a typical dive for them will be like a 35-minute hunt. And they go like crazy deep into the ocean. They'll go down, you know, routinely 2,000 or 3,000 feet. But the deepest measurement's been like 1.2 miles, which is over 6,000 feet. Now,
1.2 miles deep.
Huge. Deep, yeah.
That pop the eardrums.
They're huge. Well, they would, yes, for us, sure.
It would. You'd get the bends huge. Coming up for sure.
Oh, yeah, we'll get to that. They so they have, their average size is like 16 meters, which is like 52 feet. And the average weight is like about 50 tons. But they've measured some that like weigh like 80 tons. They eat about 3% of their body weight every single day. So it's estimated that they eat like about 91 million tons per year of seafood, and it's usually fish and squid.
Lucky bastards.
And humans as a species, we eat 115 million tons. So they're not that far off from what we eat, and they're obviously, their numbers are quite a bit smaller. Because that's, you know, 3% of your body weight. Yeah, I'm put on the over on that. That's like 1,200 pounds a day of food that you're eating. So. What's amazing too is they use echolocation to hunt, because when you're down, you know, a mile deep, there's no sunlight down there. It's pitch black. And so they have this, they're able to use this like clicking inside of their head, and it's crazy loud. They're the loudest animal on earth. And it's like, it's 230 decibels, this clicking sound, louder than a jet engine. And, they can live for like 70 years or more. If you want some facts on their like gestation, like it's kind of funny that they gestate like 14 to 16 months. And then the females will give birth like every 4 to 20 years. And, they'll like lactate for up to like 42 months, but some have even been measured up to like 13 years. like the baby's still eating from the mom. So those are like the real Buster Bluths of the whale world. So let's get a little bit like deeper and put ourselves, like shrink ourselves and go inside of the whale, like when it starts to dive. And typically they'll sort of like hyperventilate up on the surface for about 8 minutes between dives. And what they're doing is reoxygenating their system. But so if we shrink ourselves down and go inside and think about the pressure that's happening, you know, when you dive down, you know, they use oxygen just like we do to power their muscles. And when they start diving, like the pressure builds, right? So for every 33 feet of water, there's a column of water on top of you. That's one atmosphere additionally, or about 15 or, you know, PSI. So, you know, by the time you get down to half a mile below surface, you're at like 80 atmospheres. That's like 1200 PSI squishing you. So what happens if, you know, you imagine the little alveoli, the little like folds in the lungs that we have than they have. If you have that much pressure, right, it crushes their body in such a way that their lungs collapse into 1% of their normal size. Oof. When they're up on the top side. So what the problem is that when you do that, that forces so much oxygen and nitrogen into your bloodstream through the tissue inside your lungs. And so when you come back up, that nitrogen then bubbles out of your blood, right, and destroys all your cells. So that's what the bends are, right? Like it's nitrogen coming out, dissolving out of your blood. Mother Nature came up with this evolution to solve this problem. And what she did was the whales, when they start diving, they shut off their alveoli completely. So they don't, it's not like they take a big gulp of air and then go under. What they do is that they store all the oxygen locally inside of their body or inside of their muscles. So they have 2 times the hemoglobin density as humans and 10 times as much the myoglobin, which is the little protein inside your muscles that help oxygen move around. Mm-hmm. So they store all the oxygen within their muscles before they go dive. So it's not really a lung thing. They shut the lungs off. So to really like torture this analogy, other than just it's fun to learn.
Find your way back, JT. Find your way back.
Where are we going with this? But I do like it. It's very interesting.
I'm a mile under right now. So, you know, if we think about, you know, if we go on our own little hunt, you know, a deep dive for, you know, researching a company, you know, if you have to have other people's reassurances continually, that's sort of like breathing air on the top side. But being able to shut that off and having enough internal kind of metal, an internal sense of your self-worth, like the oxygen of your self-worth, storing that internally and not having to, you know, exchange it with the outside, I think allows you to go places and do things that maybe someone would say seems impossible. So there's kind of a stoicism to, you know, keeping your own mind in a way that they store oxygen locally and don't have to get self-assurance externally from other people. So very tortured, barely got it back over the finish line.
You need a lot of that as a value guy in this market. But strong self-image stored locally in the muscles. And
so it's okay to come back topside and like interact with people and kind of get recharged. But then when you go back to hunting, like shut off the lungs, get everyone else's brain, you know, everyone else's voices out of your head and like focus on the primary things for you.
I like it.
That said, I want to thank everybody that listens to us, that writes with their best idea. Shout out to all of you. I am for sourcing ideas among others. Don't take this as we don't listen when you write. We do. But yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, but you want to do your own work though, right?
Oh, 100%.
And you don't want to have the influence too much of other people when it comes to reassessing the facts for yourself, right?
Yeah, for sure. Except for on meme stocks, which you obviously buy based on the quality of the meme.
Correct.
But you have to assess the meme through your own lens. You don't ask other people how good the meme is.
That's fair. That's the new edge.
Yes, that is the new edge.
Meme analysis.
Does Wall Street Bets change anything in the markets?
Nah. I don't think this is much different. I do think that the swarm size could get bigger, though. Sorry, Jake.
Yeah, what? Sorry. No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
No, I do think, like, Mike, I do hope that we can save this episode. We've been working on it for a while now, but Non-Gap, he had mentioned that, like, if he was some of these founders, like, he would almost be concerned about, like, the Wall Street Bets plus a visionary founder taking over, like, a one of these sort of embattled companies? Does it create like a scenario where you almost see what GameStop did? And then like, can they issue capital? And all of a sudden, like, you've got this cult of, you know, like almost like a religion that's empowering valuation. And how can you attack that if you're, you know, somebody like Buffett, for instance, that's focused on cash flow? You can get people messing up wheels up, right? Versus NetJets. You give me those two businesses, sans a SPAC, NetJets will destroy wheels up over time. You get enough stupid money, like there's no guarantee that wheels up doesn't just hurt the market for both businesses. I don't think they can destroy NetJets, but they can take out a lot of value just from stupidity.
How is that different to what's been happening in the past, though? Like, there have been, you know, Icahn goes into a stock, it gets a little bit of a bump. Buffett buys a stock, it gets a little bit of a bump. You know, if somebody charismatic goes into it, like somebody goes into a, I can't really think of any examples of big turnarounds, but somebody, I don't see any reason why somebody couldn't go and take over something moribund, let everybody know about it. Hey, we got a brand new idea. We're going to raise some money. We're going to go and do some stuff. Like, that's, is that new?
No, I don't think so.
Ron Johnson at JCPenney.
Oh, yikes. Sorry, Yak Attack.
It sounded good at the time.
Well, it did, right? Not to my girl Apple Jen guy. Ross, it didn't.
Not to who?
Not to Jen Ross. She had shorted that. But I think you're right. I guess that the interesting thing to think about for me is, like, does the internet enable sort of a distributed scale that can and the depth of the options market and leverage in general? I don't know. I don't have a good enough sense, but.
So would you say two things? One, do you think that the left tail of shorting has gotten fatter and scarier with that?
Is that the downside?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, haven't you always tried to avoid, like, I thought it was like pretty common knowledge among shorts. You don't short the most heavily shorted stocks. I mean, you don't want to be long the most heavily shorted stocks either, because they're probably not going to work very well. But if you're short, then you've got borrow issues and you've got other things. Then you're captive to what the other shorts are doing. But you just want to avoid the most shorted, long or short. Why would you be short something like that in size if you're Melvin Capital? Like, why would you be short GameStop? One thing, there's a pretty reasonable argument that it was undervalued until it got to like $20. Why would you be short that thing? Like, why would you make it a big short in GME, and why would you make it a big short in your fund?
Well, I don't know how big that short position was, because I haven't.
I said they were down 50%.
Yeah, but I don't know
it
that
got
it was.
Big.
Yeah, I guess I don't know. I don't know where they were taking on water and what they had to liquidate. I don't know. But you could be using it as a funding short, right? You could be short GameStop to go long Pinterest 2x, like which looks like their book. They were also short Curate, which when they had to unwind, I trimmed a little. So shout out to Melvin Capital for giving me 10%. You'd have been. I was like, this is a little bit rich for me. So I don't know. Yeah. You should listen to my podcast with Jen Ross. She talks about this.
All right, I'll put that on.
It's really interesting. And she said exactly what you said. She's like, you shouldn't short like heavily shorted stocks. And I mean, she basically talked about how this whole situation can be set up. So I agree.
And don't short too big.
Question for you.
Sorry.
I was going to say another question for you then. If one of the hallmarks of wisdom of the crowds is heterogeneous population, heterogeneous viewpoints, does the coalescing of viewpoints in a, you know, decentralized Wall Street bets now everyone going the same direction completely foul up wisdom of the crowds? And we should expect more market inefficiency the more that we see pirating clomming together?
I mean, I'd be careful being in the stock that they're pointing at. I don't know. I think that the wisdom of the crowds breaks down when they're pointing at something, but, you know, in discovering it, probably there's a period of time where they're trying to work it out, that that's probably a good sorting process that probably does qualify as wisdom of the crowds. But once they find it and they're like pumping it, manipulating it, then you're a madman if you're in there. Mad woman. That's not gender specific. You're mad if you're in there. You're nuts. You're bonkers. Get out of it. Long or short.
I guess the thing that's tough for me to understand about Wall Street Bets, and it's because I don't have enough historical context, I just don't know what's like that much different about it than Twitter or Seeking Alpha or like Yahoo, the old internet, yeah, message boards of the time. Like, I don't think this is actually about Wall Street Bets. I think this is about some internal big hedge funds fighting, and Wall Street Bets is the beard. And I think
GME
that,
was
like,
a small stock, though. I mean, before it got to a $15 billion capitalization, it was pretty small.
Yeah, I know, but I think that there were pros that saw the whole setup and really leaned on it, and Wall Street Bets made for a nice story for everyone to write about. But I am interested to see the facts when they come out. I just don't buy the whole story that's being sold. I think it's wrong. I don't know how, though.
In the calls, though, you could see that call volume option. I mean, we've seen that calls leading other big stocks that led Tesla, and Tesla's a much bigger stock than GameStop.
Yeah, but I mean, who was buying the calls? Like, I mean, I don't know. I really don't know.
Are you saying it's market manipulation of the person buying the calls? They're trying to force up the underlying?
I'm saying it's possible. I mean, I don't buy that this is all Wall Street Bets ganging up against the big bad hedge fund. I don't know. There's something that doesn't add up to me about that story.
I always think it's funny when they like sticking it to Wall Street. Like, there's not a single person on Wall Street who thinks they're Wall Street. Everybody thinks they're the rebels. every single person's a contrarian.
Well, and the other thing that I gather is sort of unfortunate is I talked to one person that knows, what is it, Gabe Plotkin? Is that his name, right? But Melvin pretty well. And he said, like, he's actually, like, a really good guy. He's one of the few that, like, really trains up the analysts and comes down and, like, really takes the time. So, sucks, but they obviously had some risk problems.
It was all pretty quick, I guess. It went from, like, being... GameStop was a pretty small stock until it was a $15 billion stock. Even that's small these days.
Well, so your question on the call volume, right? Yeah. Like, how do we know that that's not them hedging out their exposure via calls? Because, you couldn't get shares. So, like, how... I don't know who
was. Well, the fact
they're
down
what.
50% probably gives that away.
I guess.
They
I mean, I just
well
don't...
hedge there.
Yeah, no doubt. But maybe that was how they had to. I mean, didn't he say like I'm out or whatever? And I don't have the answer. I just don't think that this is Wall Street Bets taking it to Melvin.
That shouldn't stop you from telling everyone what happened.
Well, I did a pretty decent rant earlier, so I don't want to talk about things that I don't have knowledge or strong opinions on. And I know enough to know that I don't know in this case.
Andrew Left has given up short selling as a result of this episode.
Not true. He is given up publishing short selling reports.
Is that the distinction? Okay.
Yes.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
Which makes sense.
But that's been a little bit of a game for a little while, right? Long and short for the activists. Activists short selling, activists longs. Like, yeah. I think that's the thing that people, you know, that's the thing when Musk is complaining, when Chamath is complaining, that's what they're complaining about. The shorts who are, or whoever it was, who was it Cuban who was complaining about the shorts? Like, the shorts who are... put a big short position on, then publish the research report, which I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't understand why that's such a hot button issue, but
it's like what people do. It's sewn the other way.
Cause you're not an American.
Right? I am.
I mean, I don't know.
Nobody likes the guy betting on the don't come line at the craps table. Right. He just quietly collects his chips.
I just don't. Right, so I don't understand the antipathy. Like, you go and do the work. It's massively trading over where it should be trading. You tell everybody about it. How does that make you a bad guy?
It doesn't. That's why I'm more skeptical of the people that are painting short sellers as the bad guys.
Yeah.
Right? Those are the guys that I think might actually be the bad guys. I don't care about some short seller. You know how easy it is to destroy a short seller if you're a real company? Please, Lord, launch a short attack on Charter. Do it tomorrow. Go insane. Tommy Rutt will eat your ass for lunch. I will make money.
Phrasing, Bill. That's the thing. I don't get either. What like when a CEO comes out and addresses the shorts, I'm like, why bother? What is it? What do you care?
Yeah,
it's irrelevant how the shares are held by the public.
Look at what the guy from Ubiquity, Robert Pera, did. Short sellers helped him gain a ton of money over time because he just did a buyback. And you know what talks? Cash flow. So shut up and go execute. Don't try to get short sellers banned.
The issue is for the guys who are having to head to the market all the time to raise capital.
Yeah.
Like, they don't like it. But,
like Tesla.
But, you know, there's an argument that I guess if they, I don't know.
And look, this is tough, right? Because if you're Elon Musk, I can understand why you would be like, why you would feel like shorts are trying to truncate your like vision. On the other hand, you didn't have to say you had funding secured at $420 a share.
That used to be market manipulation. You can get away with a lot more of these days. Yeah.
Between friends.
Yeah. So like, that's what I find really offensive is I find when a guy like him comes out and says like, these guys are manipulating the markets or they need to be shut down. And I look at what his actions were. Like, it just doesn't add up for me. I'm not into this.
Why didn't GameStop place some shares?
I don't know. I think
what's the CFO doing there?
Well,
you had one job.
I thought that I read that Jefferies underwrote the offering.
There was an offering to come?
I thought so, yeah. But if I was Jefferies and they tried to like stick me with the underwriting, I'd be like, we're going to court before this. Like, there's no way I'm honoring this.
That's hard, right? Because you can see that move up and down like that. Where do you price it? They needed to do it earlier this year or late last year.
Yeah, somebody's commenting. AMC floated. I don't know how they did. I honestly don't understand how. If I was Jefferies, if I'm right that Jefferies did do the underwriting, I would 100% fight that in court before I'd honor my obligation.
Do you have to underwrite it?
I think they had an underwriting.
Does it have to be underwritten? Can you just say we're just going to see how many we can get away?
I think in an underwriting, Jefferies could have been, I think, I'm now talking about stuff I don't know, but I think they could have been forced to place the shares. But my understanding is maybe GameStop's in a quiet period or something.
Yeah, so had to be something else going on, right? That's why I want, like Hertz had one on the shelf already. So
yeah,
they
to issue to Robinhood. Shocker.
Didn't the SEC stop that one though?
Yeah, I think they did after the fact though. Or they had a second one that they were going to get away? I don't know.
Gosh. Well,
crazy.
We should take some questions.
Yeah, hit us with the questions.
All right. If I continued to bet on your divorce and told people you were cheating, is the solution you just smiling and showing how much you love each other? I mean, look. I think this question is about short attacks from MD. I guess that the issue that I have is I have come across short reports on Ubiquity and National Beverage, and they forced me to work harder, and I concluded that they were wrong, and I ended up making good money. I think that like a short report should force people to think about a position, and if the company is real and people have done the work, time will tell. The longs can promote the long story all day, every day, through every single media channel everywhere. So why can't the shorts say what they're saying as long as it's in good faith?
Yeah.
Agreed.
First Amendment,
right?
Hal Holbrook passed away today. We should veil Hal Holbrook, who was Lou Mannheim in Wall Street. Too much money slushing around. Now that guy. I wish I had that whole quote teed up that I could do it.
Yeah. That would have been a better programming.
Yeah, it would have been. I didn't think of it until just then. I saw somebody tweeted something about it. How important is multiple expansion? I mean, it's nice to get. I don't rely on it.
Over the last 10 years?
Yeah, it's been everything for
really important.
It's been more. It's like 150% of the game.
Yeah.
That's not true. It's like 125% of the game.
If people do want a good conversation on the GameStop stuff, I would highly recommend This Week in Intelligent Investing with Phil Ordway, John Mihaljevic, and Elliot Turner. They did a really good episode, I thought. And I thought that they really laid out, like, the uses of short selling.
Helps you get a little bit longer. Protects the book when it goes down. You still value, just turned around the other way. It's missing some of the criteria of value long.
Yeah.
You know, you can't go to sleep on your shorts where you can go to sleep on your longs. You can wake up in 10 years' time and find it's gone to zero or up a lot, and it really doesn't make much difference.
It seems like a lot of brain drain to me. Like, it's hard enough for me to figure out how to do the long game.
I mean, if you're nervous about where the market is, like I am, and have been for an extended period of time, I want to be able to pick my longs and not worry about what the market does. And so I can have the shorts on. I know that in the event the market gets smashed up, these shorts should go down more than the market.
Yeah.
That's why I do it.
I think with the jaws stretched like they are, I mean, you have that much dispersion.
Turns out the jaws can keep on opening.
Completely love the... Well, yeah, there's no limit on the size of the jaws, but at some point there's got to be the broken jaw, right? Or a torn ligament or something.
Yeah. Goes the other way at some point.
Jesus.
Very rough market. The multiple...
I don't know. I think there's a lot of opportunity, man. I really do. Like, I just think that there's a lot of stuff going on that people... I'm really hesitant to say that the market is overvalued because I'm just, like, really worried about how I will process that public statement.
Yeah,
so I probably err on the other side of it.
It's almost irrelevant, right? It doesn't really make any difference. And it can be a little bit of a distraction because you can have a 99-2000 to 2002 kind of period where the market's going backwards, value's going up. So it's not helpful. You should just be out there hunting for undervalued stuff. It's just that when you get the big sell-offs, you know, correlations really do go to one. Everything will start trading basically the same way. And we get some big dislocations. That's a good thing if you're a value guy. It's just painful to go through. And I hate seeing people. You know, I think that the GME thing, like I thought it was an amusing sideshow. I think if you're putting any real money into that, you're crazy. Unless you're like Scotty Jackson, who got in way, way early because it was undervalued and saw one way to get out of it. But, you know, for most people, they just shouldn't have been in it. I think the bigger issue is that there's a lot of stuff out there that is crazy, crazy expensive that people are in that seem to have no clue how expensive it is.
With pretty big market caps.
Huge.
Like compounding off $50 billion, like if you think you're going to do 15% a year, like
only
that's
like
got to be
more years.
A really big company in 10 years or a really low cap rate, right? I mean, if it always perpetually trades at a 1.5% free cash flow yield, then I guess it's justified. But I hope you got something else in your portfolio to offset the duration risk.
What's that?
Yeah, no doubt.
I don't know.
Exactly. He doesn't work here anymore.
Yeah, that guy, we had to let him go. Had to let him go in about 95, 2000 maybe.
Bill, do you worry at all about the... It's very, I think, very easy to slip a little bit on your relative valuations to where you kind of can talk yourself into things that if it was a different time period and other things weren't as egregious, you wouldn't be as interested in it.
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't know what to do with that information because, like, the way that I handle it, And I'm overly allocated to equity now, and I shouldn't be. I find it hard to sell. It's a problem.
You're a young man. You'll be right.
I'm not young anymore. I don't know. Last year took some years off my life. Anyway, I guess, yeah, I do worry about it. But, like, I don't know what the answer is other than to focus on business quality and businesses I think can be bigger in the future.
I think that's a pretty good
You have to I think probably follow Munger's advice that if you can't stomach a 50% drawdown, then you don't deserve equity returns.
Yeah, it just kind of sucks when the equity return is 3% out of the gate.
I think it's 0.9.
Right.
Yeah, but there's some businesses that are. I mean, that's why I don't like to own the
index.
I see.
In terms of free, 3% out of the gate. That's fair. There's plenty of that around.
Yeah.
I got last question because we're just about to run out of time. Do you think
3%? Fuck, that was like a half of a treasury 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's a different world.
Hard to justify, right? Now it's three. Now it's free 10 years. What, this is three times riskier than the 10-year? No, it's not. Do you think index funds, specifically their auto-rebalancing towards better-performing stocks, creates a market-structured dynamic in favor of momentum? So this is Michael Green's argument, right, that the flows are dominating the market. I don't know that that's any different from what's always happened, because it seems to me that it's always been the case that everybody piles into the stuff that's working. It's just the way it goes.
Yeah, I buy that. Yeah, I mean, momentum is a persistent factor over time, right?
I mean, it seems to have worked. It seems to be more. If I talk to Wes or Meb or Corey, shout out to Corey, he's on the call from the Grand Caymans, they will tell me that it's more robust than value.
Yeah. So I don't know that. I mean, they're doing like historical backtests, so it's not as if their data set is just limited to when index funds got this big, right?
Yeah, that's been the case for a long time. Momentum, I mean, yeah. Cliff Asness wrote his PhD dissertation on it, and I think that was like mid-1990s, so it's been around for at least that long.
No.
That's time, amigos. That was fun.
I don't have hair gel on. I got product instead to whoever's asking the question.
Is there a hair gel question?
Yeah, they said, please answer this question. Are you wearing hair gel?
Like, in the Something About Mary sense?
No, that would be not hair gel, sir. And on that note, have a good week, folks.
All right, peace.
All right.
See you next
Cheers,
week.
Cheers, everybody.